Hey everyone, thank you for joining the Ultimate Night Ranger podcast, Fans of Motion. I'm a little tongue-tied because not too often. I have some great musicians and great artists on the podcast, but we got royalty, rock royalty with us today. Joining me on the podcast right below is legendary engineer, producer. I know we're like the Brady Bunch here, Ron Nevison. Ron, thank you for joining the podcast. I am grateful and taking your time. Listen, Night Ranger podcast, we're going to hit Damn Yankees. We're going to hit Night Ranger Neverland.
So you know I dated Marcia Brady, right?
No
That's
way.
why you said the Brady Bunch, right?
All right, so
Maureen
listen.
McCormick. Okay, you didn't know that.
No, well, I know Maureen
Well, now you know.
McCormick. I am a little jealous. Still a good looking girl, even at her age. All right. How did you meet Maureen
Oh,
McCormick?
well, let's start at the beginning. I
So,
was born in Philadelphia.
hey, I want to jump straight to Maureen McCormick. But yeah. Listen, Night Ranger podcast, we're going to talk Damn Yankees. We're going to talk Night Ranger Neverland. But the history that Ron has experienced and created is vast. And we're going to try to touch on as much of it as we can. But just like Ron said, the story begins in the city of brotherly love,
Right.
Philadelphia.
That's right. I'll be kind of quick with this, if I can. Grew up in a musical family. My mom was a piano teacher for the Philadelphia Conservatory of Music. I was a choir boy with the Temple University Boys Choir growing up. I had that. I was a singer in some doo-wop bands early on. I ended up working for the Festival Group, which is a sound company in Philadelphia. Worked my way up from humping the gear to a sound mixer during the 60s, late 60s. Did some I was on tour with Jefferson Airplane, Joe Cocker. I did the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour, which was a very, very famous and
Very
fun tour.
iconic tour.
Iconic, yeah. Traffic, several tours with Traffic, and
So
Derek and the Dominoes.
you're doing at that time you're doing like the front of the house
I was
sale.
doing that. I was doing different things. I was doing monitors, some depends if I worked for the Festival Group sound company, so if the artist had a front of the house guy, I didn't always do the front of the house stuff, so sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. So it was the 60s. It was early on, small mixers. It wasn't like it is today, pretty sophisticated. But during that, go ahead.
How is that? I mean, you're a young guy starting out, and what is that, just that atmosphere like when, like you mentioned Jefferson Airplane? I think, people my age, you don't realize how big Jefferson Airplane was and how kind of like revolutionary and how very current. Like they were in like Life magazine and stuff, talking about the new generation.
Well, look, I could do a whole hour just on a Jefferson Airplane tour.
Really?
But, seriously, because of the fact that after the shows, I had to try to get people out of the W bins that had taken acid. I mean, there was a light show set up behind halfway through the stage, so the setup was an enormous for 1968, 69, 67, 68, 69. It was pretty enormous setup. They had to have a certain amount of room behind the stage to have a rear projection light show. I don't know if you remember, a company called Headlights did the lights. I was doing the sound. The touring, the live mixing that I did for all those bands, didn't, I was getting burned out. I wasn't like flying with the band anywhere in any private planes. I was driving the trucks, I was humping the gear, I was mixing the sound, doing all that. And it took its toll. I was riding with Chris Blackwell, who is the head of Island Records. This was like in 1969 or something. He was also the manager of Traffic. We were on tour. So that's Stevie Winwood and band. And I had a discussion with him. I told him how I was, not sure how long I could keep doing this. He said, "Well, what do you want to do?" I said, "I'd like to take the what I've learned live mixing and go into the studio." And so he right then offered me a job at Island Studios in London, which is a very major point in my career. It took me from Philadelphia in early 1970 to London, and put me in a recording studio. So it was quite a major thing to do. Also, financially, I took a gigantic hit because I was making pretty good money as a sound mixer, and nothing as a tape op on Basing Street in London. And so, but it was a start for me for my the next phase of my engineering producing career. So from that point of view, it's a very important thing that happened to me. And I did, it didn't take me long in the studio to learn the what I needed to learn because I knew a lot about performance. I knew a lot about microphones and preamps and reverbs and all sorts of things. What I didn't know is how that applied to recording. So I had a leg up, I guess you could say, on a lot of the other young engineers that were coming up through the system. And so it didn't take me long to start doing sessions. And by 1973, I was working for Pete Townshend with a company called Track Plan, helping to build recording studios for musicians. And I built a live studio in an Airstream trailer for Ronnie Lane, who was the bass player in the Faces. And I ended up using that to cut the tracks on Quadrophenia with The Who. I used that for the making of the half of the songs on Physical Graffiti, Led Zeppelin in 74. The first couple of Bad Company albums, I used that unit in rented houses. And then, yeah, there you go. And then, I think the second Bad Company album, I rented a castle in Wales during the winter that they just used for medieval feasts on a Saturday night, and we recorded there. So yeah, that was my engineering days, and I was doing big albums as an engineer, and then I started producing in '74. I did a Thin Lizzy record
Yeah.
called Life. And in 75, I had built a studio for Ronnie Wood at his house, a big, beautiful house called The Wick, very, very old 1770s Edwardian mansion. I think it was Edwardian, it could have been earlier than that. The Faces were breaking up at that point. Rod Stewart was leaving. Ronnie Wood was on the verge of joining the Rolling Stones.
Stones, yep.
So that's when that was, 74, 75. And the Faces had one more album to do with Warner Brothers. But nobody wanted to contribute any material. I went in the studio with them and tried to do it, but after a couple of weeks, it didn't work. So they decided to do a live album, record a live album. So they hired the record plant in Los Angeles to do it while they were touring in the States. And during the tour, there was a break, and Ronnie Wood invited the two owners of the record plant, who he had made friends with, Gary Kellgren and Chris Stone, to London to hang out. So I was in Woody's house doing a session, and I met them, and they were impressed with the fact that I was American, the fact that I had done these albums with Zeppelin and Bad Company and The Who, and I did the Tommy Film soundtrack. I had done a lot by then, and they hired me to be the chief engineer at the record plant. And at that time, a lot of people were leaving London, the Rolling Stones and Rod Stewart and Elton all moved to LA and Monaco and places like that. And people were leaving town. There was oil embargoes and coal strikes, and it was just time to go. And I had enjoyed my 4 years in London. I really had no plans to go, but this was a great opportunity. This is all building up to my next phase of my career, which was as an engineer producer in Los Angeles at the record plant.
Could you briefly describe the difference between an engineer and a producer, what those job qualities entail?
Yeah. An engineer is kind of like a cinematographer, and his job is to get the sounds right for the producer, using the right microphones and techniques and all that. The producer's job is to hire the right engineer and get the right performances from the artist. It's almost like the producer is like the director, the film director, and the engineer is like the guy, the camera guy, a
Okay,
similar kind of thing.
that's
And
a
so
good analogy.
one person doing everything is kind of like a cinematographer stroke director.
Okay.
It's not like a film producer who generally just puts up the money, and organizes the everything. So yeah, hope that answers that.
So you transition into being the lead engineer producer.
It's a very simple thought. The engineers aren't generally royalty artists, and the producers are. So if you want to make any money, you become a producer. And so that was my goal, to be successful in all phases, to do great work. And there's different levels of happiness, when you're making records. The first level is, are you happy with the product that you made? And everybody's happy with it, and you walk out of the studio. The second level is, when it comes out, is the public happy with it? Do they buy it? Certainly, if you do a great record and nobody buys it, there's a certain level of happiness that's negated right there. So the best scenario is when you do some great products and everybody loves them, and they're platinum records, and you move on.
So was there ever, because you become producer, was there ever any record, and I'm kind of jumping a little ahead here, but
That's
was there
right.
any record that you ever, what's a record that you produced, maybe engineered, that you were very high of that didn't do well? Just like you said, where you produce something, you got the work done, the public loves it, it's great. Was there ever something that you thought this is great and maybe the public just didn't get
Yeah, there was a bunch of those.
it?
Do we have to?
No, we don't, but
I think that one in particular is Chicago 21. I did Chicago 19, and I thought I had some great hits on 21, and for some reason, I mean, it was still a gold record, or it wasn't pl double platinum, I guess. So that's a disappointment. But there was records in between down the road that I thought, there was records that I turned in where the A&R guy for the record company wasn't there anymore, and there was nobody to champion it. It's by the time that I turn an album in until the time it comes out 6 months later, there's a lot of changes. I did an album with Patti Smyth in 1990, in 1991, for Columbia Records. And when I turned it in, it was Sony. And Tommy Mottola didn't want it for political reasons. That prick. And so, yeah, don't get me started. Don't
All
get me
right.
started.
So you become you achieve that goal of being the producer, and there were some artists that you kind of go full circle with, one being Jefferson Starship at this time, where you
Yeah.
had started out as just a crew member,
Right.
and now you're going to
Good
be in
question.
charge of producing the
Good
record.
question. And when I got a call in 1979, excuse me, from my manager, that he told me that Starship's looking for a producer, and so is Santana. So I want you to go up to San Francisco and have an interview with those guys. Now, I had been on tour with Airplane, but I worked for Festival Group Sound. I wasn't an employee of Jefferson Airplane, but I did their sound, right? So on tour with them, so I knew the guys. But when I went up to San Francisco, I remember getting picked up at the airport and going to SIR and meeting with the Santana guys. And honestly, as far as it goes, I never really thought Santana would make it in a big sense, because they didn't have the Carlos was the star in Santana. The singer was always secondary. I didn't like that arrangement. So I went to see Starship, and they had a brand new singer, Mickey Thomas, at the time. And they had a new drummer, Ainsley Dunbar, who was a monster drummer, and they had some great tunes. And immediately I had a bond with them again. I did not tell them, nor did they notice, that it was the same guy. I had shaved my beard off. I wasn't. They might have thought that they had seen me before, but I didn't tell them. I didn't tell them until the third album that I did with Starship. I'm sitting with the roadies. I'm saying, at some point, they say, "You're from Philly, right? Were you on tour with us?" Okay. This is like in 1983. So that's a great question. About that, because do they really want a roadie stroke sound guy to be their producer? Are they going to trust that? A lot had gone down from 1960 68 to 1979 with me. But so I didn't say anything. Figured, well, if I have to bring it up, I will.
And by
And
that third album, you
the
were
same thing happened with Joe Cocker.
okay.
Because I did Joe Cocker, Mad Dogs and Englishmen in 69. And then in 85, I flew to London to do a Joe Cocker record at Air Studios. He didn't remember me. He didn't remember anybody, Joe. He was amazing, though. We had a great time.
And
So
this.
that was very interesting that, yeah, that I did go full circle. Yeah, there you go. I did go full circle with a couple of artists, as far as early on in their careers and then later on in their careers.
Because that would be difficult. I mean, it's convenient that, luck that they didn't remember, but it'd be like, you working for a company and I hire someone brand new, green, train them, and then years later they're your boss, kind of.
Yeah.
And that can create,
That's why I didn't bring it up.
But did you, I mean, we've been, talking about here with Jefferson Starship, Jefferson Airplane,
Yeah.
did you do any of the like Woods, because you were with that festival company, did
Yeah,
you
I
do
mixed their sound at
Woodstock?
Woodstock. I mixed Jefferson Airplane at Woodstock, yeah.
All right. And
I climbed out in the rainy conditions over a horde of people out to the sound tower. I'll never forget having to kind of make sure I didn't step on anybody to get out there and get up and climb up into the booth. And yeah, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning or something. They went off.
yeah, they
Crazy. I don't
played in like the
remember, but it
middle of.
was wild. It was a wild couple of days there.
Did.
Let me just say something about my take on Woodstock.
Okay.
It was a fucking disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it was awful. The conditions were awful. They've somehow made it into this amazing time. I don't know if anybody had a good time or not. It rained. It was mud. There was a half a million people. There was no services. I even sent the Jefferson Airplane truck down to New York City to buy oranges to bring back to for people to have food. It was really pretty bad. In the green room, which is the backstage area, somebody had put acid in the big vats of water and lemonade and stuff, and people were tripping out, even kids, which was terrible to have that happen. I mean, I couldn't wait, but the rooms that we had to share with, so I had 12 hours of room, and then another person would take that room. I mean, it was just, hate to blow anybody's bubble, but that was just fucked up, man.
Well, it's like the mythology of it is probably
Yeah.
bigger than the actual facts, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And did you know at the time? I mean, I know you couldn't have, but did you ever think when you were there that that festival, because at the time there were lots of festivals, did you ever think that one, did you ever think it'd be what it is today where it's idolized and it's a myth, the mythology of Woodstock?
No. I mean, the film helped out bring that a lot. The live stuff, and that's good stuff. I can't take that away. But I did a summer of festivals. I mean, with the airplane that summer, we did the New Orleans Pop Festival. We did Atlantic City Pop Festival. We did probably more than those, and Woodstock, of course, that was summer of '69. Lots of festivals, all the Monterey a couple of years earlier will set that up,
Well, you're right. Probably what's helped with that mythology of Woodstock is the film. I mean,
right?
that's what's so great about it is
Yeah,
back then there's not a lot of film of anybody. So to see the film of the
and there's
Who
no
and
mosquitoes,
yeah, and you don't have to wade through the mud and
right?
over people to actually to watch it. So where are we at in the chronological world
Well,
of Brahms?
we're kind of at the record plant in the after 1975, and when I got there, and I did a few albums before I did the Starship record that were important records. I did the third Bad Company record in the south of France.
Which one's the third one? Is that
Running with the Pack. I
and
did
that's
all. I did the first three of their
three,
albums.
but
Yeah,
and which would be the self-titled record? And
the Bad Company. Yeah, Bad Company. Straight Shooter was the second
right
one.
there, one of
Yeah,
my favorites.
I did
And
that. I did those first two albums with the Ronnie Lane Mobile LMS, Lane's Mobile Sound, that I built for him, and of course took the finished product into a studio to mix it and do some overdubs, but most of the recording on those records was done at different places. One was at Headley Grange, where I did the Zeppelin Physical Graffiti tracks, and did the Bad Company there too, because it was the same manager.
I mean
And this,
those three records, I mean the right there, those three
yeah, I
records,
know,
Ron, are just
all in that period
that
too.
you could hang your career just on those three records.
I have.
Well, I mean, you got so much more. I'm just saying, it just boggles my mind. I'm sorry, but yeah. So you got those records. What's some of the other important records from that time period?
Well, those are that's it. Well, the Who Quadrophenia was a very, very important and took 8 months to do. That was a very, very, I mean, it was sound effects. It was supposed to be in quad. That was all done in it. The Who built a studio in London just for quad sound, because there was no quad studios, and they decided in the end not to do it because the record company let them down on the quad system. So we just ended up doing stereo, but still, it was a lot of work. And then I did, almost right after that, I did the Physical Graffiti record and the Bad Company record, and then I came back and I did the Tommy film soundtrack, which took almost a year to do. And then I did another Bad Company record where we did it at a castle called the Clearwell Castle in Monmouth, which is near Wales. That was fun. And then I did a Thin Lizzy record, and those were the important records I did in that time period from 73, 74, 75, before I came to LA. When I got to LA, I did a great record with Flo and Eddie called Moving Targets.
All right.
I then did a record with UFO called Lights Out, but I went back to London to do that. There you go. Love that. Loved working with those guys, and it started a record where I did three records with the UFO. I did that one. I did Obsession. Then I did a live record called Strangers in the Night, which is a fabulous live record. And because of that, the Crystals called me up to do The Babies, another English rock band. I did that. I did those. I did two albums with The Babies in the late 70s in LA with the Record Plant remote truck, and I rented houses to do those albums. And
With the Babies, for those that don't know, was basically the
yeah.
career starter for John
John
Waits,
Waite, that's right.
and was Jonathan Cain in that
No.
lineup? No, okay,
No. He
but
was not in the he was not during the two albums that I did. But I did work with Jonathan with Bad English, with one album with Bad English. Yeah. I worked with Neil and John on that with John Waite. I did not get along with John Waite very well, I have to admit. One of the few artists I can honestly say is a real shit,
Well,
but that's my opinion, and I love his voice. The songs were very cool, but personally, I didn't care for the guy.
but you did two albums, I
Well, I
mean,
did three.
three.
When I was we're jumping out of my chronological thing, which I don't like to do.
I'm sorry.
But let me get back to that.
Yeah.
It helps me. So, going into 1980, I did an Eddie Money album, and I did an album I love. I didn't Eddie and I were both having issues with drugs and alcohol at that point. It was a very brief period of time for me, maybe 1 year. After working in rock and roll for at that point so many years, I look back on that and I say, that's not so bad,
Yeah.
really. But it was a bad year, 1979, 19, not 1979, 1980, 1981. I did an Outlaws record called Ghost Riders in the Sky. In fact, one of my best friends, Freddie Salem, just passed away this past few months. Guy that I've kept in touch with for a long time. I love that record. Early 80s. I then I guess what happened was I got a call. I should go back one step because I did a Survivor record in at the Record Plant in 78 or 79, one that
Okay.
never came out.
Really?
I had a fight with the A&R guy, who later became a good friend of mine. And I left the project. My assistant engineer on that project was a guy named Mike Klink, who became famous for as a producer with Guns N' Roses a few years later. So Mike finished the record for me. But Survivor was annoyed that I'd left the record, and they really wanted to work with me again. So when they left that label and got signed a couple of years later, they called me up to do the Karate film soundtrack, a song called Moment of Truth. So I did that in Chicago, and then they signed me up to do the Vital Signs album, which I had a bunch of big hits on, platinum record in 84. And from that record, I think I got the attention of Heart, because I was on the charts. I was a Led Zeppelin engineer, which they loved Led Zeppelin. So the combination of both led me to do Heart in 1984, which came out in 85, the self-titled album. That's one. Yeah, that's it. Which was enormous. I mean, it sold to the moment. I mean, 6 or 7 million records, I think. And then
Gave him a
the
second
follow-up to
career.
that. Huh?
It gave
Yeah.
him a second career.
It did. It did. And then I did a follow-up called Bad Animals, which was 3 million or something. So yeah, that was so during that time period, okay, we're finally gonna get to this. I get a call from Night Ranger's manager about working with the band. I think it was in early 86.
Sounds about right.
Okay. And I said, yeah. I told him that I'd be available. And I wasn't. I was out. I was in, by that time, I was in Europe, the summer of 86. Instead of tending to the business, I was chasing women in Paris. I regret that. And when it came time in 1989, when I got a call from John Kalodner, the very same guy that I had a fight with about Survivor, who I said became my good friend, who was the A&R head of Geffen, pitching me on Damn Yankees. What ultimately happened was John had put the band together. He had put Jack Blades and Ted Nugent and Tommy Shaw together. Tommy had this drummer, Michael Carlone, came along, and that was the band. However, Ed Rosenblatt, the president of Geffen, didn't see it. I don't know why. I don't know if anybody can believe that, but it was true. So it went over to Michael Austin at Warner Brothers. So then I talked to Michael. I went in, listened to the demos, loved it. And I told Michael, there's only one thing. I said, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I really messed up and I told Jack Blades I was going to do an album and I didn't show up for it. And I don't know if he's holding a grudge against me for that.
Well,
Okay.
you know what's funny is right before we started this interview, I was talking to Jack Blades on the phone, and the story you just said about the reason not doing Big Life is what he thought happened. He's like, I think he went and chased a girl.
What happened?
So there that
There's no use lying about it.
and you're right, the album that they were looking to get you to do eventually
Yeah.
became this record,
Yep.
which ironic is they replaced you with another front of this house sound guy,
Yeah.
Kevin Nelson,
Kevin, yeah.
who was front of the house for Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Right.
And this magazine, Song Hits, is really about the only good article I have that one of the members talked about. We decided it was time for a change to get a new set of ears. Ron Nevison was going to do it, but he bailed out 2 weeks prior to the sessions. They didn't get any into anything else, but this is one of the best sources that I had for, hey,
I thought it was longer than 2 weeks before. I thought,
who
but
knows.
it could have been.
But yeah, I always wondered what would have happened if that record had been produced by you, because obviously Damn Yankees was such a success. That album didn't do quite as good in the Night Ranger catalog as the previous three, but yeah, going back to Damn Yankees, and you were talking about Geffen passing on that demo had coming of age, high enough, come again. I mean, it
Of
wasn't
course.
like it didn't have
Well,
the
you know,
hits.
very, look, I can give you an analogy here to Bad Company. Paul Rodgers had was a writer in the band with Free, along with Andy Frazier, who was another writer, along with Paul Kossoff, who did writing. Paul did a lot of writing on the piano. And he had a lot of songs that clashed with Free, or that he didn't get, that Andy didn't like, or whatever, you know. And he was saving them. You know, if you look at Mick Ralph's, Ian Hunter was the main guy in that band.
Which
And
was
since
Mott.
Paul had, Mick Ralph's had Can't Get Enough, he had that written, you know. So he had that stuff written. And you bring in Tommy Shaw, going flipping to Damn Yankees. You bring in Tommy Shaw and Jack Blades, prolific writers that get together that had come up with these songs that weren't maybe right for their previous bands, or maybe they were. But you know, they it's like these super groups come together, and the first record are always great because they have those tunes in hand. Meanwhile, you know, you make a record, you go out on tour, and you don't have a whole lot of time to write the next record. That's in the old days. And the second records always suffered from that.
And in getting with Damn Yankees, and we mentioned it briefly with Heart, where I said with that Heart record, you gave them a second career. Your records are almost like that with, Ozzy's coming off of, Bark at the Moon was just an okay record. It wasn't the first two, and Bark at the Moon was a okay track, but you pushed it to another level with The Ultimate Sin, with a big MTV commercial hit.
You have to drag them kicking and screaming onto the charts. I fought with Sharon and Ozzy about Shot in the Dark. They didn't want to do it. Just sounded too commercial. Great, commercial, that means success, right? Doesn't it? And you know, Phil Soussan shot me that song, you know, the bass player the bass player that. And I thought it was great for them. And he had played to Ozzy, and Ozzy said no. And so I said yes, and I said, let's try it. Let's try and make it, you know. Anyway, I remember Sharon calling me up, what's the next single after Shot in the Dark, after it was a success? I said, there is no next single because you wouldn't even let me do this one. What do you mean next single? So there's a lesson there. Okay? Don't meddle.
But yeah, you
Hire the
did.
right people
And listen to him.
and don't meddle. You know, that's where a guy like John Kalodner is fantastic, you know, except for the meddling part. An A&R guy should be like a marriage broker. You should put the people together and then leave them alone after the wedding. Okay? So, yeah.
But this record here, again,
Well,
a record that, in the Kiss world, some fans love it, some are against it.
nice lick. I have a feeling this is going to be a